This is The Geek Dads, the podcast of geekdad.com. This is episode 134, spoilers. This is The Geek Dads, episode number 134. I'm Ken Denby, publisher, editor-at-large for Geek Dad, and he is Matt Blum, editor-in-chief of Geek Dad, and we are here yet again to talk about the geeky things that have happened in the last couple of weeks. Matt, how's it going, man? It feels like ages since we've spoken. It's probably only been 2 weeks.
You've been a little busy.
It feels like ages. Holy cow!
Yeah. I saw some of the pictures from Maker Faire. Wish I could have gone.
It was spectacular and awe-inspiring and completely and utterly exhausting. I mean, you know, all right. So this would be my sixth Maker Faire. Mm-hmm. The previous five times have been just a sponsor, which means going in on the Friday before, setting up a booth, doing all the planning and everything, hauling a bunch of stuff in. I mean, last year I actually rented a truck to haul everything in. We kept it a lot simpler this year. Hauled everything in, set it up on Friday, and then ran the booth for 2 days, and then broke it all down, and then went back to work on Monday. So the little bit of difference this year, as some of you know, I started a new job last Monday as well, the week before Maker Faire, and that was with Make. And so I actually started the week working Maker Faire, meaning that I was actually over in San Mateo, and involved both in sort of the pre-planning for the editorial, and they had had this thing called the Hardware Innovation Workshop. Up at the College of San Mateo, up on the hill above the town, which was really fascinating by itself. It was this big, not big, actually, a few hundred people, and it was sort of a workshop, seminar, meet and greet, talks by people that have gone from, garage maker with an idea to prototype to funding to putting out hardware. A lot of the speakers were people, Bunny Wang of Chumby fame and many other things. Right. And Zach, I'm going to forget his last name, one of the three partners of MakerBot. And a number of people. What's that?
I know who you mean, but I can't think of his last name
either. Right, right. And a number of other people of that ilk, people that were makers that came up with an awesome idea and successfully brought it to market, talking about what they'd gone through and the pitfalls to look out for. And it was attended by a few hundred people at various points in that evolution, going there to, first of all, learn some stuff that they don't know yet about what they're about to go through and what they need to remember, and secondarily to make contacts that might actually help them along the way, which is fantastic. I mean, some of the talks about, the guy from MakerBot talking, he literally moved to Shenzhen and lives there now full time because he wanted to be embedded in all of the industry there, and told just amazing stories about how you can go from a design on your computer to holding a board in your hand in 24 hours, a printed circuit board, because everything is can turn on a dime there. You can walk in, bring your design, pay whatever, a few hundred bucks, a few thousand dollars, and have your prototype board to test the next day. Just amazing stuff. And it's great. I mean, we got, our own patron, Chris Anderson, spoke talking about his walk from the Lego Mindstorms brained UAV that he created that was his first post at Geek Dad, all the way through to now his, multi-million dollar 3D robotics company. just, you know, doing the same stuff. So it was, you know, a very inspiring day. A couple of days, actually, met some really cool people. The ShopBot folks, who are like one of the make favorite, CNC companies, showed off their new device, which is called the HandyBot, which is basically a hand movable, holdable CNC. It has a frame that's about 2 feet wide by a foot and a half with big handles on it, weighs about 35, 40 pounds. So this frame, you can move it, put it down on a piece of wood that you want to cut, and then the whole router with, you know, six axis movement is inside the frame. It has the laser guide, and then right now their prototypes are running off of Windows tablets that you literally mount to the side of the device. So you set it down. You could actually run CAD software on the tablet if you want to, or their ultimate goal is to have this open API or open dev kit so that people will actually write apps for each process that you want to do. So if you want to do scrolled letters, just carving that into a piece of wood, you download the app for that. If you want to cut mortises and doors, you download the app for that. You want to, you know, do special joints, you download the app for it. Set the shot bot in the right place, align the laser, boom, goes, does the job. And it'll even, you can download the design and print and cut out the framework so that you can then build and mount it vertically, so you can do, you know, cuts in walls and mortising door frames and things like that. Everybody who saw this thing was drooling over what it means in terms of, you know, the power to do some amazing things right in your home workshop. So it were cool. And then we rolled into two full days of setup and Maker Faire, which was as magical as it ever is. Just phenomenal. Two beautiful days. A whole ton of really cool stuff there. You know, there's a lot of stuff that you're familiar with that's classic. You know, the life-size Mousetrap was there, Architect was there, the EP Bird guys were there doing the Coke Zero and Mentos fountains. But, you know, similarly, lots of different art displays, a whole bunch of different makers and vendors doing stuff. Our good friends at Vex were right next door to us. They were showing off their new robot platform that they've set, you know, Lego Mindstorm squarely in their sights with. It's, you know, to step down from the one that they use for all of their championship robot competition. It's firmly aimed at that home, you know, just build it yourself up to the other level. You know, it has a brain just like the Mindstorm's brick. It has parts that actually will connect in, you know, in theory, more interesting ways than Mindstorm stuff will too. So I don't know. There's a lot of challenge out there right now for that kind of thing. But and so they worked me hard and put me away wet. It was the heck of a weekend. Although highlights, of course, were and this picture is up over on the Maker Faire site was. First of all, I got to stand just below Adam Savage giving his keynote. And then after that, I got to actually pull him aside for a second and interview him and shook his hand and all of that. And there's an awesome picture on the front of MakerFaire.com that I was like, I'll be happy with that forever. That was phenomenal. But it was really funny because you see sort of on one hand the two levels of celebrity. On the other hand, you don't necessarily envy Adam. Adam gets brought in maybe only 2 degrees less security than the president. Literally pulled up outside the gate in a big black SUV with handlers, making sure he was meeting the right people and getting to the right place and all that stuff, which was awesome. And then later on, I had the personal honor of being able to arrange for tickets for Grant Imahara.
Oh, cool.
And so later on, I just, you know, Grant got there. He texted me. We met over by the R2s. He just hung out with the R2 guys. And then I got him on camera for like 10 minutes, and he was a ton of fun. I got to introduce him to my boys. Just fantastic. And he's, you know, he's just the guy hanging out. It was fun. Mm-hmm. And got to hang out. They were doing a number of live Google Plus Hangout interviews, being hosted by this guy, Jerry James Stone. He does a cooking Google Hangout podcast called Cooking Stoned, which has a lot of followers. And he came down and did some interviews, got to meet Veronica Belmont, which was also very cool. And and then worked my butt off, walked that whole fair all over the place, wrote a lot of content for it, ran the live, hosted the live stream, especially both mornings where you'd go to one of the entrances and then we would ribbon off an area inside. This is sort of like what they do at cons where you're given your tickets and you go into a big room and wait to get to flood into the con at the same time. They did the same thing at the fair. Let everybody who was already there inside the gate and then do a big countdown and break the ribbon to let everybody run into the fair. And that was really a blast.
Very cool.
So that was my little week of work, 7 days straight. And then we got to take a couple of days off a little bit here at home and be heading into the office tomorrow.
Is that on?
That's all.
Yeah. Trial by fire, right? Yeah.
It was certainly a trial by fire, but it was a lot of fun.
Sure.
And it's amazing what these folks pull off. I mean, you know, they're partnered with an event company to do a lot of the big organization and stuff. And there's all.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I mean, it, but
so, everybody, so you do that yourself.
Yeah. But everybody at Make pitches in. Sure. You know, only like 35, 40 staff, but everybody pitches in. You know the name Andrew Terranova?
Sounds somewhat familiar.
Yeah, he was one of the more active people over on geekdad.hotwired.com.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's where.
He actually writes a little bit for Make as a freelancer. They brought him out to cover to help with all the reportage over the week, cool. And so I got to hang out with Andrew. He is an awesome guy, and hoping we'll you know, hopefully he'll get more involved in our new forums and the new community site and so forth. But awesome guy. So that was just a little bit of the last fortnight that was so exciting. So how does it feel, Mr. Editor-in-Chief?
It's good. I've been enjoying it. Hasn't been, you know, we haven't had any, you know, anything any huge critical problems happen, which is good.
Which is nice. Power hasn't gone to your head yet.
Oh, I don't know. I'm gonna start chopping people's heads off here, you know, for minor transgressions. You never know.
It's gonna take a lot of travel to pull off.
That's true. I'll have to delegate it.
It's an excuse to start to take a circle around the states though.
No, that's true.
Hey, Matt's in town. Great to see you. Shink. Oh. Oh my goodness. All right. Well, you know, so nobody else joined us for the podcast tonight, which maybe, you know, I was hoping someone would show up just to act as a buffer. Because I tweeted something today and you had an immediate visceral response to that. And we should have.
You obviously hadn't seen the tweets that I had sent immediately after sending them.
Exactly. I hadn't noticed that. So, folks, let's plant this right now. The next 10 to 20 minutes of this podcast are going to probably be extremely spoiler laden for Star Trek Into Darkness.
Yes,
because we're going to talk about it now, and we will go over a lot of the details. And on the other hand, I'm not going to debate too hard. This is going to be one of those chats that is two people coming from you know obviously similar fan attitudes towards the whole canon. Just had two really different experiences with this film. And it's, you know, one of it, there is no right and wrong here. This is two people had two different experiences. So, you know, we'll talk a little bit about that, but, you know, definitely listen. If you haven't, well, no, if you haven't seen the movie yet, you really probably don't want to listen to this because it'll spoil the heck out of it for you. Although if you don't care about spoilers and want to really get to, you know, the root of why some people seem to be thinking some way and some people seem to be thinking the other, maybe this will help you.
I was actually just reading IO9 has something very much like what I was going to write, but I'll write it differently.
Exactly.
Have you read it?
I have scrolled through that and thought it was amusing and a bit hyperbolic, but you know.
But accurate.
A bit hyperbolic, but.
Can you disagree with most of it? I mean, fundamentally.
Yes, I can.
Well, okay.
I think we're in the spoiler area, right? Yeah, so you know what? I'll going to put it this way because you know what? I know, you know, there are points to be made that are plot holes.
Well, the plot holes are giant. I mean, they started off with the
and
with
that's
the
your Enterprise. Reaction to it.
They're the not Enterprise to me, in care. The fucking ocean.
All right, now we have to edit.
Yeah, well, so it's under behind the spoiler warning anyway.
Why not?
Because it's a starship, and because it's not made to take the stresses are completely.
It has shields.
Which
it has inertial dampeners. It has everything.
The shields weren't being used.
It's science fiction. Why do we care?
Because it would have been snapped like a twig when it got out of the water. And
do you have the specs? You've studied up the specs on the starship.
Well, how about this? They were concerned about the alien race seeing them right when they got out of the water. How did they get into the water?
They did it well. The alien race was in the village when they went into the water. They drew the alien race out to the edge
because a giant starship going into the ocean doesn't make a ripple, right? It would create a freaking tidal wave. Something that
you know, I hope Hikaru is a better, you know, a better pilot than that, and set her down.
There. Yes, into the water where you know where you could easily you know rip the hull open on just about anything.
Once again, I haven't seen the specs for this new ship. I have no idea.
Yeah.
What she can take and what she can't take.
Not meant. The reason why they have transporters and shuttles is because it wasn't meant to go on land. Let alone under the water.
That went into the atmosphere in Old Trek, and you know this one's. I have no problem suspending my disbelief for this because it's science fiction.
Yes, and then again, why did they have to drop Spock into the volcano? Why couldn't they just drop the bomb into the volcano?
Good question.
I mean, really, because otherwise, because if they did that, Spock wouldn't be in peril, and they wouldn't have to rescue him because the plot demanded it.
Yeah, so?
Well, that's ridiculous, too. And they just, I mean, and also I love that it's supposed to be a cold fusion bomb.
Yeah, that was a silly name.
I'm sorry, because cold fusion is still hot.
We can call him a... Well,
cold fusion is still really, really hot. All it means is that it starts cold. That's what cold fusion means. It's that, you start
cold. We misunderstand. He actually said cold fusing. And it was using cold to fuse the lava. Now, I am not here. I will honestly say I will agree with you on a number of these points. I am not here to defend every single fact of this movie because there you know, in the same way, why the heck didn't Gandalf just let Frodo fly to fly with the giant eagles all the way to the mountain to get rid of the ring?
Well, I've always assumed that was because Sauron would have noticed and killed him.
That's an assumption, though. Nobody ever says that.
Because it's kind of hard to hide when you're flying in.
All right, now you're going back. Now you see, you're allowing it in one case. You're making assumptions to allow for a plot hole in one story, but you won't allow them in another story.
Well, because I can come up with a reasonable explanation in this case. I can't come up with a reasonable explanation in the other case.
No, they're playing. I mean, you know, they said they couldn't beam them down from the ship. They couldn't get close enough because of the magnetic fields, but they could get closer when, So, you know.
The beaming up, that's fine. But why did they have to put him in there in the first place? Why couldn't they just drop the bomb?
They're going to pinpoint. Well, he had to do some setup with the bomb too. Didn't you notice that there was actual process that had to go on? Somebody had to be there to do it.
They can't do that remotely, really, in the 23rd century, really. We can do that now.
They can't fly a ring into Mordor, really? They can't. I think there's a broader issue here.
Lord of the Rings is based on magic, right? So you can pretty much explain anything by saying, well, you know, it's magic.
Oh, it was all magic to those natives.
Star Trek is supposedly science fiction, and therefore at least has to
come I dare you to be able to defend that position on any of the Star Trek movies.
Oh, you think I'm you think
starting with time travel.
Well, you can get, I mean, let me say, no, you
starting
think,
with I'm, the slingshot I'm, around the sun, which you just no, it doesn't. It doesn't work.
Of course, you have to make certain allowances, but I'm saying, but fundamentally, some parts of it, like it's not supposed to all be magic. It's supposed to fundamentally, some parts of it are supposed. It's not supposed to require as much suspension of disbelief as something that's pure fantasy, like Lord of the Rings.
That's all I'm saying. All I'm saying is, I had a wonderful time with this movie.
Okay, I thought it was a great action film. I thought it freaking sucked as a Star Trek film.
I thought it was a great Star Trek film. I think it was second only to Wrath of Khan.
Terrible.
As well, a great Star Trek
film. It came really close to ruining Wrath of Khan.
No, I think it raised Wrath of Khan on a pedestal.
Yeah. See, I completely disagree.
I think it honored Wrath of Khan. I think it reverently held that story up.
Suppose somebody remade Empire Strikes Back with a new cast. And then they decided, we'll have Luke tell Vader that he's
And if
he's
they Vader's. Did it as well as, first of all, this is not a remake of Wrath of Khan. This is not a remake of Space Seed. This is a retelling of a story with many of the same characters.
And in a making the exact in a same timeline. Lines, even. I'm sorry, that was ridiculous.
I totally disagree. These are characters in similar situations.
Yeah, I felt insulted. Experiences. I actually felt insulted.
I thought it was choice. I cried. Okay. I loved it.
Okay. I had the exact opposite reaction. Gene Siskel,
you're an idiot.
I had the exact opposite reaction. I felt like my memory of Wrath of Khan was actually being insulted.
It tied me to it and elevated me.
Yeah. I totally don't see that. Not at all. Wrath of Khan is...
I pity you, sir.
It's a fantastic film, and I mean, also the whole bogus crap when they were trying to say, he's not Khan, he's John Harrison, in preparation for the film. It was like, okay, the only reason they hired... I mean, I love Benedict Cumberbatch. He's a great actor. I love him. I really do. But they should never have hired him for this role.
Oh, he was fantastic. He was the right choice. He was absolutely the right choice.
He was the right choice. If he hadn't been Khan, he would have been the right choice. No, but I'm sorry, right you role, don't, period. In 2013, I think it's somewhat offensive to hire a white guy to play an Indian guy, to play somebody who's Indian, somebody who is so obviously not even close to being of Indian descent. The one look at Benedict Cumberbatch will tell you that. He's also got the most British name ever in history. I mean, seriously. And I mean, the only reason they did that was so that they could, because if they had hired somebody of Indian descent, everybody would have known that he was supposed to be Khan ahead of time.
No, they hired the best actor for the role.
No, they didn't.
And he was phenomenal.
That's bullcrap. There's tons of people.
No, it's not. You can't call it bullcrap because it is my absolute honest opinion.
Okay, but in my absolute honest opinion, it's crap. I think he's a fantastic actor, but I think that there are plenty of other actors who could have played Khan who would actually have looked like Khan.
Well, then you're stereotyping what, the other character. I mean, because Ricardo Montalban was not Indian either.
No, of course not. But he was at least not white, and that was in 1967 when he was hired, right?
That meant so little.
Slightly different time, and they could have at least had the decency to readjust the time frame so that the eugenics wars wouldn't have still occurred in the 1990s. Because in 1967, that was plausible. In 2013, not so much. I lived in the 1990s. I don't remember any eugenics wars, do you?
Wow. Your inability to suspend disbelief and to go with a great story with great acting is shocking to me, man.
Different movies, sir.
We saw the same movie with two wildly different emotional perspectives coming into it.
And seriously, why the fuck did they need the dreadnought in the first place?
All right.
Sorry. But why did they need the dreadnought in the first place? They established that you have a transporter that can beam somebody from Earth to Kronos, right? Because Khan does that. Why do you need a ship? You want to beat them? Beam bombs into their capital city.
Yeah, you know,
beam commandos into their capital city. Why go to the trouble of spending a fortune, which that ship must have cost, to build that ship? Not to mention hiding that ship, which must have cost a fortune too, because hiding something from all the technology that Starfleet has, even if you're the head of Starfleet, cannot be an easy thing to do.
Yeah, once again, that's all supposition that has nothing to do with the story.
Okay, but
you're building arguments against things that aren't even established or even thought of.
But there is a transporter that takes you from Earth to Kronos.
I actually didn't even catch that. So my understanding was he beamed out and then he hightailed it there by his ship.
No, whatever. They because how would they have known where he went? Remember, they were able to figure out where he went by Scotty looked at the transporter.
Oh, by the wreckage of the thing.
By the wreckage of it, and figured out that those coordinates were on Kronos. If he had beamed onto a ship and gone there,
go back and look at that. Because that would.
If they had beamed onto a ship and gone there, how would they have known where he went?
Yeah, but they have that technology, or had he taken it, or he developed it?
No, well, the thing is,
destroyed it all in 31.
No, it got destroyed, and he had used the one tube that they had left after the explosion. But the point is, why would they have gone to that effort in the first place if they had that technology to begin with?
Well, that's, he wanted a bigger thing to swing at people.
No, it's totally impossible. He wanted something to beat the Klingons. It's
impossible.
Impossible.
He wouldn't put all his eggs in one basket.
He wanted to start a war with the Klingons, then he wanted the dreadnought.
You can't beam through shields.
You can with the transwarp thing. They did that. They did that in the first movie. Scotty invented this thing that allows you to beam through. That's how they beamed onto the Enterprise as it was going past in warp with its shields up.
Shields were up? I
believe so. Besides, it was going past in warp. If you can do that, you can beam through the damn shield.
Oh, okay. I'll check the tech specs again on that.
Seriously.
I love this film. It was a great film.
Okay, I said I thought it was a great action film. I thought the Star Trek pieces of it were kind of insulting and really, really, really bad.
Second best Star Trek film ever made.
Oh, horribly.
That's
a terrible disservice to Star Trek 4.
The role. I've always thought Star Trek 4 was silly. It's not a bad film, but it's
silly. But it's a great film.
Yeah, sort of.
It is a very silly film, but it's also
it,
a lot.
It was
also
only the second grade of Star Trek film because all the rest were worse.
No.
Actually, I like three. I always thought three was underrated.
Three is underrated.
Think one is a great science fiction film.
Yes, it just goes on far too long.
Yeah.
They were way too in love with the special effects.
Yeah. Although if you can take, if you can be patient, it's a great science fiction film like 2001 with these big ponderous, gorgeous, and it was all practical effects back then, which was wonderful. Yeah, so it was wonderful. But
I would have been much, much happier with this film if they had created a new story instead of why did they have to raid an old story? Why couldn't they have created a brand new story?
Well, actually, here's the thing. I've read. Stephen Toulouse did a great spoiler-filled look at this, and yeah, you know what? He picks up on a lot of those little road bumps in it too. And I don't disagree with this, but because this film affected me so emotionally, I'm glad to let those go. He makes a really good point about the issue of why didn't they just ignore Khan and do something else or whatever, and let's see if I can sum up what he says. Wrath of Khan hangs over the entire Star Trek movie franchise like some type of curse. The first film, the original Star Trek The Motion Picture, has been seen by fandom as good but ponderous. It's slow and tackles deep philosophical issues. Wrath of Khan was a bit of a thrill ride where our illustrious crew faced their age, a confoundingly evil adversary, nearly lost a ship, rose to the occasion, and made sacrifices at once that for once were painful and immediate. The Kirk in Wrath of Khan was a man who had fought for everything he had and had never really failed. He cheated death, tricked his way out of it, and patted himself on the back for the ingenuity. We got our hearts broken, whatever. Unfortunately, it was so impactful that every single film following it, except Star Trek IV, tried to recapture that lightning in a bottle. Cold open that has little to do with the ensuing plot. Strong villain with unique personality traits to play foil to the captain. Beam up to the Enterprise to the point where it's either, or beat up the Enterprise till it's either destroyed or semi-functional to create tension, so forth. But what this one does right, let me see, let's see where he gets to his summary, because he makes a number of good points here. Patience. And yeah, he does point out a number of those little things. Oh, like, yeah, he does point out, and I agree with this, Carol Marcus was completely pointless to the plot.
Oh, absolutely. And actually, even Damon Lindelof has admitted in Twitter that having her disrobe there was just completely gratuitous.
Oh yeah, it was really dumb.
Did you really need to put that in there? I'm sorry. Yeah. That's just
totally, and I will also totally agree. We had a little talk on a little banter on this on Twitter. Whilst my audience did not laugh at it where yours did, the Spock screaming Khan did not work. They did not pull that one off.
That was totally unnecessary. It's like, okay, yeah, everybody knows there's a big jokey joke about, you know, William Shatner going, right. You know, it's like, yes, it was, he overplayed the moment. Everybody knows that. And it didn't help that they make it appear that it's reverberating through space by pulling back from the planetoid when he does it.
Right.
Okay. As if it were possible to reverberate something through space. But, that was just having Spock do that. No.
Yeah. However, everything leading up to that, I thought was tremendous.
I would have far preferred it if they had just left it with Kirk dying, and not done all the perfect role reversal with his almost exactly the exact same lines.
Oh no, I love that. I cried.
Oh, see, I totally didn't.
I was a sobbing mess.
I rolled my eyes throughout that entire bit.
No, I thought they pulled it off great, because I think these two actors...
Because I saw it coming, and I totally was like, okay, focus.
No, I saw it coming, and it sent shivers up my spines, and then the way the two actors pulled it off, the way it was written, was pitch perfect. And that was, you know, and that's why, and here it is. We came into it, and just in two parallel universes. And
well, see, the reason it worked so well in Star Trek II, the original Star Trek II, is that Kirk and Spock were not just friends. I mean, they had been friends for most of their lives. I mean, they had fought together. They had been on hundreds of missions together. They had been on the ship for years together. They knew each other better than anybody else. That's not true of this Kirk and Spock. They've known each other. They've known each other for a little while, and they're not that close. And it's why did not work for me, because it totally works when it's William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy doing it in Wrath of Khan, because you know what they've been through. You know, they've actually been through that. This Kirk and Spock haven't done that yet. They haven't earned that yet. They don't have that friendship yet.
And I thought that the way they developed the lead up to it was perfect. And I thought they did earn it. I thought that, and especially because what was going on here was, you know, in both versions of this scene, it's about Kirk learning, an emotional journey, Kirk arriving someplace he hadn't been before. In the original, it was, you know, this idea of Kirk, you know, never losing, finally having to lose and deal with that. And in this one, they did a really good job of setting up that at this point he was too brash, never thought about the repercussions of his actions, never took responsibility for what he had done, and coming to the place where he realized everything bad that was happening at the moment, the risk to his crew, was his fault, and he needed to be the one to fix it.
Yeah,
that is an emotional journey for a younger Kirk.
If they had left it at that, I would have been fine. It was the scene between Kirk and Spock that I thought was a mistake, because it cheapened, I thought, and, you know, that's what I felt. It yeah. cheapened the scene between Shatner and Nimoy in Wrath of Khan, or because that was such an emotional scene because of what they had been through together. If they had, I mean, Kirk's sacrifice in the movie, that's fine. I mean, I actually thought that did pretty much work. It was the scene between him and Spock that I thought did not work, because they did not have the same kind of friendship yet, because they simply didn't have the established history. They hadn't been through everything that old Kirk and old Spock had been through in Star Trek and Wrath of Khan, just, you know, the, you know, 20 years old, you know, 20, 25 years older. I mean, it's that's why that part of it, and because, and also because they had the laziness to, in my opinion, to use the exact same lines only reversed. I mean, I thought that was totally bogus.
I took it as homage, and I thought the way they built it up with the emotional journey that Spock was going through, and this is a very interestingly different Spock.
Yeah, but they gotta get rid of the stupid relationship with Uhura. I'm sorry, I don't buy it anytime. I don't buy a single minute of it.
I think it's fun. I like it.
I think I don't buy it. I mean, it doesn't make sense for either character. No, Jonathan says he can join, but he can't stick around. He said that 20 minutes ago.
Oh, well. It's probably just as well he didn't. All right, so there we go. We'll take our Siskel and Ebert, and I'll be thumbs up, and you can be.
Listen, I thought
thumbs sideways.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, good action film, really, really crappy Star Trek film.
Good action film, second best Star Trek film.
No, yeah, not even close. Not even close.
Right there.
In fact, I almost don't even want to think of it as a Star Trek film, because it cheapens Wrath of Khan so much.
Yep, I think it elevates Wrath of Khan.
And I honestly, I don't know what everybody else is seeing about Chris Pine, because I think he's okay, but he's an action star. He's not an actor.
Yeah, he's settled into the role quite nicely, and there were moments where
he makes me appreciate William Shatner a whole lot more.
Yeah, there were moments when he was saying something off screen, and I thought I heard Shatner, not in a mocking way, but in an honest, that was Kirk speaking way. So
I did not get that.
So when you actually go see the real Star Trek Into Darkness, maybe you'll see some of what I saw. But
well, and they totally missed the point of Star Trek, which is that it's supposed to be, you know, and I mean, Abrams even said this when he was on Tonight Show, I think. He said, you know, that one of the things he never liked about Star Trek was that they spent too much time thinking and talking. It's like, yeah, that's what it's about. I mean, that's what made it different, is that it was about something. Well, no, they always tackled issues. They actually had the balls to tackle real world issues that other people were afraid of in the TV show. They actually went after some real issues that were important in the world that nobody else was doing. And presented, I mean, they didn't always do it well.
Right, but they haven't done that in the films at this point.
It's
a different market. But
even in the films, they do, they're still about something. Like, there's still thought involved. There's philosophy. That was not there in either of the two Abrams films. And he's admitted as much. He said before he made the first film that he didn't like Star Trek very much when he was growing up. That he was never a Star Trek fan.
That's why he's got writers who are.
Why the heck did you take the job? I mean, I'm looking forward more to his when he does with Star Wars, because at least I think he'll do well by that, because he said, you know, he always loved Star Wars growing up. So that fact means I think he'll probably be much more careful with how he treats the memory of that than he has been with Star Trek. Because honestly, at this point, I'm not going to go see the third film.
Good. There'll be more seats.
Not a chance. Yes, because that's you living in California. That's a problem.
Well, you know, it settles out. It all spreads out. Man. So there it is. All right. So anybody who watches the podcast, there you go. Two Star Trek fans and geeks completely, you know, realistically 50% completely different. 50%. Yeah. But yeah, that's right. Opinions of the film, because you liked it as an action film, and I enjoyed it as an action film, and the other stuff we're split on, but that's cool. That's cool. I'm sure there's something that you loved that I hated somewhere. Like Star Trek 4. No, I didn't hate Star Trek 4. I just always...
How could you hate Star Trek 4?
You know what it is? is Star Trek 4. Talk about a movie that you know, obviously it's sort of in the vein of like Mudd's Women and a few things like that, but that one, it was slapstick in places that it just didn't feel right to me. And
I thought that when they had the comedy in there, I thought it actually worked pretty well.
And then once again, you know, the point that's also been made about it is that it was basically a recreation of motion picture.
Well, except for the resolution, but yeah.
Yeah.
I don't remember any whales, so that was fun, but...
But I mean, you know, the whole you know, strange, mysterious alien probe comes to Earth looking to potentially destroy
Star Trek: The Motion Picture was a remake of which original series episode was that? The one with Nomad.
Yeah,
I can't remember the name of the episode off the top of my head. Yeah, the Nomad, Sterilize. You know,
so few original science fiction ideas out there one way or the other.
Oh, absolutely. But that's where they took the idea from, clearly. Yeah. And, you know, where, you know, it turned out to be Voyager and everything. But the same as Nomad was one of the original probes that had gone out and acquired other technology. I mean, that was the exact same thing that happened to Voyager.
Yeah. Yeah.
To become Voyager. What was I going to say? The only thing about Star Trek IV, I will say, is that it has not aged well, because it's very 80s.
Very much of its time.
But that's okay. I mean, it's still actually kind of fun in some ways to see the 80s references and such. And, you know, it's... Hello, computer.
Hello, yeah. Computer.
Oh. Yeah. Oh, yes. And we are looking for the nuclear vessels. Nuclear vessels.
I love Anton Yelchin's Chekhov. I think he's so cute.
I will say that a few little sly references that they did work in, I did like some of them, like the they did make the reference to Harry Mudd.
Yeah, my wife didn't even catch that. I'm going, did you get that? Did you get that?
Because it just slides by, you know, that they fixed up the ship since the Mudd incident.
That's cute.
I like that, because only these Trekkies are gonna know what the hell that means.
Exactly.
That was nice. So that I thought that was nice. I thought that was a nice little thing to stick in there. And there were one or two other things. I really wasn't happy with what they did with Pike.
We're done with the debate.
Yeah.
But anyway. No more points to be made on either side. We're done.
I will say one more good thing about that, it was nice to see Peter Weller chew up some scenery again.
Oh, okay. I was actually holding off on saying it. I thought he was great fun.
It's just fun to watch him chew up scenery. He's just good at it. He's so good at it.
You know? Oh, what was it? My older son thought that it was David Carradine, because the way he spoke was just about dead on the way Bill spoke in Kill Bill. This sort of big put on almost Western. Well, boy, we're gonna go do. You know, it was kind of funny, but yeah, I just said no. It's Buckaroo Banzai.
Have you checked out the pictures of like all the models that were on his desk?
I remember catching about two-thirds, you know, a third of the way through, focusing on it and saying, oh, those look cool. What else was there?
Well, QMX made them.
Oh, neat.
So they have the yeah, well, it's got the Enterprise from Enterprise, you know, the NX-01.
Oh.
which I thought it's got the Kelvin from the first
right.
film.
Right.
Trying to remember what else it has. It has like it has a little rocket. It has the Wright Flyer. The original Wright Flyer.
Right.
I can't remember what rocket it has.
So basically, it's the entire montage from the opening credits of Enterprise.
It's the history of space flight, basically.
Well, yeah, but you remember the opening. Yeah,
did they have the Wright Flyer in there? I don't think they did.
I think it was very early. Maybe. Now we got to go find it and play it. But yeah.
Yeah, just turn off the music. But yeah. That was the worst part of that show, and that's saying something, because that show just got so bad.
No, it started out bad. The last season I actually really enjoyed.
Okay, I had long since
you had left by that. They actually started dealing with founding of the Federation and stuff that would lead into canon stuff, and it was kind of fun.
I did actually tune in for the very last episode, which I thought was horrible.
Yeah,
that was just terrible. I'm sorry. Trying to work in Riker and everything, it was like, you didn't need to do that. That was just stupid.
But when they did some early end Dorian stuff, and they had some fun with some canon stuff early on, but in that last season. But yeah, it had problems. Besides, the first captain of the Enterprise was Robert April, as we all know.
Yes, except of course that the animated series is not canon.
It was in the pitch script too. That was also and a couple of the books which are not canon, but that was one of the they probably planned it this way. The last Antiques Roadshow, one of the things that they found that somebody brought in was her father was a physicist or whatever, and in 1964 Roddenberry sent him a copy of his pitch document to go over some of the scientific stuff in it and see whether or not he wanted to be a science consultant for the show, which he declined, but he held on to the pitch document and stuff. It was only worth like $2,500. I would have said, you take that to a con and auction it off. It'll go for $50,000.
Quite possible. Have you heard about Warehouse 13, I assume? It has been canceled.
Eventually. Oh no, I hadn't heard.
Yeah, they're giving it a short season to after this one ends to wrap things up. But that's a
Sci-Fi does it again.
Yep, they did it to Eureka. They did it to every. They apparently want to do this to every fun sci-fi series that they or fantasy type series. I guess.
I have a feeling it's like when a show is successful enough that it starts costing a little bit more, it hits some sort of line and they kill it.
Yeah, it could be. Okay, actually, I was looking at the full list of the models. They're all going to be on sale from QMX at some point. It's got the Wright Flyer. It's got the Spirit of St. Louis, a V2 rocket, a NASA X-15, Vostok. Gemini capsule, XVC 330 ring ship. I'm not really sure where that's from. Oh, is that 2001? That might be 2001. The Phoenix, of course, from is that from Cochrane? From First Contact,
right?
NX Alpha. Not sure what the heck what that's from.
NX.
Then. Yeah, I'm not sure. That's like the early model. I think you see that in one of the Enterprise episodes. It's the early model because the Enterprise is NX-01.
Right.
I think you see it in one of them. But anyway, then there's NX-01, and then there's the USS Kelvin. So they went to a lot of effort there, and they're really cool models too. They have close ups of them. If you go to IO9, you can find them.
Yeah.
And you can also buy all the division badges if you want them. And then, of course, the phasers.
Yeah, you know, some of the phaser stuff, they made them look cool, but some of what they did just seemed a little over. It was like you loaded the thing in and this thing flipped around on the phaser, and it was like, wow, a lot of moving parts to get broken.
Yeah, it did not seem like something that people like. It seemed like poor design. It's like this will look cool in a film, but nobody would actually design something that way.
Yeah, exactly. It was like
I always say the
solid state is really nice. Okay.
Yeah, it's like something. If you're gonna make something like that, you make it as usable as possible, right? Yeah, because people you want people not to hurt themselves with, since it is a very powerful weapon. Would not be that hard to do. You want it to be very easily portable, et cetera, et cetera. But looking cool is way down on the list of things that you needed to do if you are building it.
Okay, here we go. A complete list of the shots in the opening credits of Star Trek Enterprise.
Yeah, it had to be out there somewhere.
The ship, let's see, Renaissance Diagram of Celestial Mechanics, Show from Hell, let's see. Okay, Polynesian Raft with Sail Sunship, HMS Enterprise Map, Fade in the Sailing Ship.
Oh, see, that's right, it had ships, it didn't have flyers.
Right, so it had the Spirit of St. Louis, Space Shuttle Enterprise, the Wright Flyer, the Bell X-1, the Deep Flight Submarine, Chuck Yeager walking away from the X-1. Let's see. Underneath the Saturn V firing. Space shuttle. First date. Let's see. Astronaut in the MMU low Earth orbit. Holding into a handhold to open shuttle bay. Buzz Aldrin. Lunar excursion model. Zoom of Marth Pathfinder. International Space Station, Space Station Gantry, let's see. Phoenix Flight, Earth, early warp ship SS Emmett, flying over Earth Colony and X-01.
I was right, by the way, the NX Alpha was one of the first ships built to test the warp engine. The Lips, and Jonathan Archer was one of the people who was testing it. And the NX Alpha was the one that blew up, and then they... because they pushed it too far,
right?
The pilot pushed it too far.
That must have been established like in the early Enterprise.
Yeah, it was in Enterprise. And the XCV-330, the ring ship, was supposed to be one of the other Enterprises, which was it was an Earth starship, also named Enterprise. There's an Enterprise episode called First Flight, which is where both of those are from.
Got it. Hey, we've spent a lot of time working through one subject. I want to bring up, let's see, one other thing that just happened today, which was the announcement of the Xbox One.
Yeah. It's interesting. I don't know.
I think it's a travesty. I think it does a disservice to the memory of the Xbox 360.
The memory of the Xbox 360. Yes, that long-held classic that everybody loves unabashedly.
Yeah, I know. I just have to say, if ever a name was designed by a marketing department.
Oh, God, yeah.
The third Xbox will be the Xbox One.
Yes, I got a little tired of every single person on Twitter thinking they were clever by saying, oh, they just subtracted 359.
What?
I must have seen that about 100 times, I think, going by on Twitter. Like, okay, you're not clever.
No.
Every single person who heard the number thought that.
I think this sounds interesting, Okay, so in terms of the gaming stuff, it's obviously it's a contemporary computer now, so it's a heck of a lot more powerful. It's like...
Sure, and you got to realize when the 360 came out, things were still...
Yeah. It was state of the art for its time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And they improved it by adding the Kinect, but that... Yeah. The Kinect was actually they put out a little ahead of when they really should have.
Right,
technology wasn't really ready yet. The next generation Kinect that they talked about does sound pretty darn cool.
It really does.
that it can even detect your heartbeat, which that's pretty cool.
Pretty crazy. Yeah, because it's actually using three different cameras at the same time to get, you know, it's like infrared, a regular HD video camera, and then an infrared and one thing else. So it can, first of all, it can see you without regard for visible light. So even if you're in low light, that won't affect the performance. And then it has real good depth perception. And then, yeah, it can pick up like variations in your skin tone, and it can pick up facial expressions fairly well, up to six people in a room at the same time. And, yep. You know, seeing what this can do makes me really paranoid about what about the technology that's in use that we don't know about.
Well, there's that, yeah. But this has to be in your living room to do it.
Yeah. And then it's a pass-through device, so you run your cable or satellite or whatever through this, and it can act as a separate program guide. And adds all sorts of like picture-in-picture side stuff with voice control, so that you can be sitting there, like watching something, and call up something via Xbox, or play a game on one side and have your show going on the other, or be watching a sports event and watch your fantasy football stats updated in real time, or a whole bunch of stuff, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, it would be if they come through on what they promised, it should be pretty cool.
And Blu-ray has finally won the DVD wars.
Yeah, yes, shockingly. Yeah, I liked that they were saying, and it does play as Blu-ray. I was like, of course it plays Blu-ray. Yeah.
However, the one thing that will make us all curse their names is that it is not backward compatible.
Yes, well, the PlayStation 4 isn't going to be either, so.
Nope. What are they, Apple?
Well, no, I think they pay taxes.
Apple pays taxes on... I heard the whole thing, yeah. Yeah, that is an excellent point. They pay taxes on the money that they make in a country in that country, period.
Except they're trying to avoid taxes by this convenient little loophole.
Well, they keep the money in those countries.
Well, no, I mean, you heard about what the scheme that they're doing, apparently, but that the government says they're doing, is that they have these companies that they own that are based in Ireland. I think it's Ireland, they said.
Right.
So that they don't have to pay U.S. taxes because they're based in Ireland. But the way the Irish tax system works, the parent company is based in the U.S., and that's where these companies do most of their business, they assume that the companies will pay the taxes there.
Interesting.
So it's like, oh, so basically each one pawns it off on the other one, and neither one of them actually collects. Mm-hmm. Thereby, they avoid paying taxes, which seems unfair.
So, but you know, it came down to, and I hesitate to say this because he's, you know, insane on so many other things, but as I recall, Rand Paul's opening statement to the whole thing was, you know what? It's not their fault that they're doing what they have to do within the letter of the law to, you know, be successful as a business. It's our fault as a Congress for setting up a tax code that lets them get away with this.
Yes, well, I learned today that I don't want to talk too much about politics, but that one of the people that Rand Paul actually has as one of his advisors actually came out and accused the government of causing the Oklahoma tornadoes using a weather control device.
Well, you know, after seeing the technology in this new Xbox, I wouldn't put it past them.
It's like... you are completely nuts. Yeah. I'm sorry.
It's
one thing to be a conspiracy theorist, but it's another thing. I'm sorry. You're completely nuts.
That's a little bit far around the bend. Yeah.
I do have to say, speaking of the Oklahoma thing, which is of course, you know, a horrible tragedy, but that there was a really good article on CNN. I can't remember who by, but on CNN.com, about somebody saying, you know, it's times like this we should really remind the people, all those people who think that teachers are overpaid. Look at what these teachers did.
Oh, yeah.
Shielded their students with their bodies from falling debris, you know, carried them out bodily while they themselves were, you know, bloodied. And it's like, how could you possibly pay them enough to do that?
I'm
married to a teacher too. Yeah, I understand. Yeah. But really, I mean, you look at what these teachers did. They're overpaid. Of course, they're not overpaid. Yeah. How could you? You can't overpay somebody to do that for your child. It's not possible.
Yep. All right. What do we got? What do we got going on over at this site I've heard of called Geek Dad?
Well, we've got the cool Studio Ghibli, I never know how to pronounce that.
I've heard it, Studio Ghibli, actually.
That could be. I wonder if I saw how it was written in Japanese, I could tell you.
There you go.
But, because I actually took Japanese once upon a time.
Probably not hard to find.
Probably not. So there's a giveaway of the Blu-ray, which I must go out and buy, of my neighbor Totoro and Howl's Moving Castle.
Oh yeah.
Which, oh my god, just looking at the preview, it's gorgeous. You mean even more beautiful than it already was? I mean,
yeah.
Oh my god, that's gorgeous. I must get this. They're already such great films and just so beautiful. I put up another one of my posts in the series about my trip to Pixar and about Monsters University, which comes out a month from today, which is cool. Just in time for summer.
Very nice. Very nice.
yeah. I'm trying to think what else. Yeah.
That sounds like enough.
Yeah, we got a bunch of stuff going on. There's a bunch of good posts in the hopper, a bunch of game reviews up, including one of a cool Kickstarter for a dystopian future. It's actually currently the top article underneath the podcast.
Excellent.
Yeah, Curtis put that up. That looks pretty cool. One of our newest writers, Melissa, has a piece about betting with her kids and the games Zurika, like betting, like going to sleep early or, you know, extra dessert and things like that, which is kind of a cool piece.
Neat. Very neat.
Yeah. So
we got a nice new crew of occasional contributors there, don't we?
We do indeed.
Awesome. We do indeed. All right. You know, the last thing I'll bring up, I want to point everyone to something. I won't get a chance to post it, but it just caught my fancy today, specifically because my mine is a family of bowlers. And Randall Monroe's What If comic for which day did it go up? It's in the last couple of days. It's about bowling balls. And basically, about what if you blew a bowling ball up to the size of the earth, what would it be? First of all, would it be smoother or rougher than the earth? And it turns out, if you magnify what a bowling ball is like to that size, it would be extremely much smoother than the earth.
Sure.
In fact, the difference between the lowest points and the highest points would be less than the height of the Eiffel Tower.
That's assuming you're getting rid of the finger holes.
Hold on. We're not to the finger holes yet.
Okay.
We're not to the finger holes yet. Also, what would the bowling ball world be like? First of all, we call it Lebowski. The planet Lebowski. Because bowling balls are a lot less dense than rock, Lebowski's surface gravity would be about a quarter that of Earth's. Kind of nice. No fun. Unfortunately, at first, it would have no atmosphere, so we'd all die. But
yes, that is the problem with having less gravity.
Right. The finger holes would be about 1,000 kilometers across and a few thousand kilometers deep.
Depends on how they're drilled, doesn't it? I mean, like,
true.
People have different size fingers.
Well, usually the depth is standard, pretty uniform. Right? Yeah, yeah. On Earth, the holes this big would expose the molten interior, but Lebowski does not have a molten interior because it's uniform all the way through. But the Earth's core is hot for two reasons. It was still glowing from the heat of all the dust collapsing together when it was formed, and it's full of radioactive materials. Lebowski doesn't have either of these, so its core would start out cold. However, let's see, the holes would be far too big to hold themselves open against gravity. At this scale, the polymers in the bowling balls would behave more like a liquid, and in the space of about an hour, the holes would undergo a slow-motion collapse. As they collapsed, the material around the holes would heat to a glow. At the center of the hole, a white-hot jet of charred hydrocarbons would fountain outward to space. When it was over, Lebowski would be left with massive scars, each marking the location where an abyss collapsed to form a molten sea. And now, thanks to this question, whenever I look at the moon, I'll notice the Sea of Tranquility, the Sea of Serenity, and the Sea of Crisis, and I'll think, finger holes.
That's very cute.
I love it. I love it.
I love Randall Munroe. Have you seen I haven't looked at it recently, but the Time XKCD?
I haven't checked in on it lately.
Yeah, but you know what it is, right?
Yes.
I believe it is still changing.
That's so cool.
Yes. I don't know where he finds the time to do that, but yeah. One other thing I did want to mention that I posted about on the blog is the Geek and Sundry has their new vlogger channel.
Yes, I heard about that.
That they've opened up. They have eight now, which I've only seen a couple of them, but they're pretty cool. They have one doing stuff about cool language stuff, so that's pretty cool.
Very good.
But they're looking for more, so they want people to go there and put up videos about cool stuff and anything geeky, really. They said, you know, anything from, you know, including like thumb wrestling was one of the examples they gave. So, you know, really anything, any topic that you want, just as long as you're excited about it.
I like
it. Put it up there, and they're gonna, you know, have people will be able to vote on them, and then they'll also have, you know, people there who will decide, and then they'll talk about who gets the job in at VidFest in August.
You know who out of all of the geek dads would probably do really well at that? Curtis.
He could, yeah. I was actually going to go with Z, but Curtis could too.
Z would be wonderful as well. Absolutely. If he just did you know, chiptunes and nerdcore as a yeah. That's it. We need to get him to rechristen Hipster Please as a vlog on Geek and Sundry.
Yeah. Got nothing to lose, right?
I like, yeah.
It's free to a paw.
All right, man. Well, this has been awesome. Even if it was just the two of us arguing over stuff. That makes for a good podcast, I think.
Yes, it does.
All right. This has been The Geek Dads, episode number 134. I have been and always shall be your friend. And then meet it. Publisher and editor at large of geekdad.com. Matt, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Ken. I'm so tempted to say Ken. But anyway,
you had to do it. Okay. All right, everybody.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for hosting as usual.
All right. Thanks, everyone. We'll be back in two short weeks. Hopefully they'll seem shorter this time. And until then, yeah, keep it geeky, everyone. Have a good one. So long. Bye. Geek Dad. Geek Dad. Geek Dad. Geek Dad. Geek Dad. Geek Dad.